Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, your host. On today's show, Diverse Voices Book Review contributor Amanda Moore interviews Stephen B. Bright and James Kwok, authors of The Fear of Too Much Justice, Race, Poverty, and the Persistence of Inequality in the Criminal Courts.
Today, I am speaking with Mr. Stephen Bright and Mr. James Kwok. Steve currently teaches law at both Yale and Georgetown universities. He was the longtime director of the Southern Center for Human Rights and has won multiple capital cases in the Supreme Court. He is a recipient of the American Bar Association's Thurgood Marshall Award. He has been the subject of two books, Proximity to Death by William S. McFeely and Finding Life on Death Row by Katya Lexon. He has also been the subject of the film Fighting for Life in the Death Belt by Adam Ellen and Jeff Marks. He lives in Lexington, Kentucky. Mr. James Kwok is the vice chair of the Southern Center for Human Rights and a former professor of law at the University of Connecticut. He is the author of Economism, Bad Economics, and the Rise of Inequality. And he is a co-author with Simon Johnson of White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. He is also the author of the New York Times bestseller, 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover, and The Next Financial Meltdown. He is also the co-author of The Baseline Scenario, a leading blog on economics and public policy. He lives in Amherst, Massachusetts. They are both the authors of their new book entitled The Fear of Too Much Justice, Race, Poverty, and the Persistence of Inequality in the Criminal Courts. Stephen and James, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So for our listeners who have not read the book yet, can you please give us a brief overview of what is in store for them?
Well, sure. The book basically takes all aspects of the criminal legal system, starting with prosecution, talking about the power of prosecutors, the enormous power of prosecutors. Unfortunately, the problems with counsel for many people, lawyers for many people accused of crimes, the politics of judging, the issues of mental health in the criminal legal system, the fines and fees and the courts that operate more for profit than for justice in many places, sentencing and excessive sentencing, and the river that sort of runs through the entire book is race, the way in which race influences everything in the system, from the charging to selection of juries to severity of sentence that's imposed.
And how did this collaboration begin? Like, how did you decide to work together on this particular project?
So I met Steve when I went to law school. So Steve has been teaching at Yale for 30 years now. And so I went to law school relatively late in life. I started in 2008. And Steve teaches a famous class he's taught at Yale and Georgetown and many other places on capital punishment, race, and poverty, essentially. So I took his class. I was lucky enough to take his class my first year at Yale. There are always more people who want to take it than can fit in the classroom. But I got in. And you know, the class had a big impact on me, as it has on many other people. My last year of law school, I also took the capital punishment clinic. So that was a class at Yale where we would work on actual death penalty cases, mainly in Connecticut, some federal cases as well. So I worked on some of the last death penalty cases in the state, because it was repealed right around then by the state legislature. And after I graduated, we stayed in touch. I became involved with the Southern Center. So Steve was still working at the Southern Center at the time, and I became a board member. And we would see each other, you know, at least once a year in New Haven. Often we'd see each other at Southern Center events as well. And I knew that Steve had been thinking about writing a book for a long time. So I met with him and I said, this is something that I think is really important. I don't know the topic, you know, I don't have 30 years of experience. Steve has 50 years of experience as a defense lawyer. I don't have that level of experience, but I know how to write books and I care a lot about the issues. And so he was happy to take me on.
That's awesome. What I appreciated about your book was how incredibly thorough you both were in examining the current problems with our legal system from all of the angles. As you mentioned before, Steve, you cover the defendant, the lawyer, the judges, the court system, politics, prison, almost everything that could be connected with the case. So with so many issues that arise in the criminal justice system, how did you choose these particular topics to focus on?
Well, these are the things we think are most critical in terms of the, as we say, the lack of fairness, the race, poverty, the role that they play. For example, in the chapter on prosecutors, we talk about the tremendous power that prosecutors have in deciding what to charge people with. Almost all the cases in the criminal legal system are resolved with plea bargains. A prosecutor can threaten, for example, the death penalty. And if you plead guilty, you'll avoid the death penalty. But if you do not, and the case goes to trial, you can be sentenced to death. Even though the prosecutor may agree that you don't really deserve the death penalty, willing to give you life in prison, but the penalty for not taking the plea is going to trial and getting the death penalty. And of course, that happens in all sort of other ways. Very often people are facing, 5 years in prison, but they're told if you go to trial, you're going to get 20 years. So most cases are resolved with guilty pleas as a result of that. Also, prosecutors have a power that nobody else in the system has, which is to reward people for testifying the way they want in cases. And that happens all the time. We talk a lot about the jailhouse snitch, the person who has charges pending and who goes to the prosecutor and says, I will say that this person told me he committed the crime. It seems odd that the person would tell you, I mean, why would you do that? But this happens all the time. And many of these people, as we point out, testify in lots of cases. Every time they get in trouble, they go to the prosecution and offer to testify against somebody else. And of course, also the prosecutor has all the information from the police investigations, from their own investigations, grand juries, all of that. And so there's a tremendous amount of power there. So we talk about the myth of the adversary system. And then, of course, with regard to the other side, with regard to a poor person accused of a crime, very often they don't have the kind of legal representation that's necessary for a fair fight.
I'd just like to add that on the topic of like why we cover the topics we do, a lot of them come out of Steve's experience or the experience of the Southern Center also. So we're talking about the right to counsel, for example, Steve and the Southern Center were real pioneers in fighting for the right to counsel in the South. Georgia now has a public defender system. It was established around 2004, largely because of advocacy and litigation done by Steve and the Southern Center. Another example I'll just mention is there's a chapter on judges, the politicization of the judiciary. That's a topic that Steve has been very outspoken on in the past. So on the one hand, we think it is kind of a catalog of the structural problems in the criminal legal system, but a lot of it comes out of the direct experience of Steve and other people at the Southern Center as well.
Okay. You open the book with the story of Glenn Ford, and he was a Black man who was convicted of robbing a jewelry store and murdering its owner, who was a white man. He was later exonerated and released. And through this story you write about, or through this case, you write about the inexperienced defense attorneys, the prosecutors who removed all of the prospective Black jurors, and how this verdict was upheld with no murder weapon or eyewitnesses. It was, as you wrote, and I quote, a complete breakdown of the process for determining guilt and punishment. When you see cases like this, based on cases that you've seen over the years, is it fair to say that a case that is properly investigated should never really go to trial? I mean, what's something that you're seeing as a result of when they neglect procedures and process?
Well, we took that case because it is representative of so many of the problems that we talk about in the book, the power of the prosecutor. That case, it was really unique in that Glenn Ford ultimately was released after 30 years, tragically 30 years on death row in Louisiana. But the prosecutor actually wrote a letter to the local newspaper in Shreveport and apologized and said, you know, I was young, I was ambitious, I didn't care very much about fairness, I just wanted to win. And it didn't strike me as being that unfair that he had two lawyers that had no idea how to try a case, that he had an all-white jury, this African-American man tried. So in many ways, that case is just very representative of the things that we talked about. There's no question. I think what we see is that very often what you talked about, lack of investigation particularly, results in miscarriages of justice. And as we point out in that case and many others, the system is failing in its most fundamental responsibility, which is to separate the innocent from the guilty. I mean, that is, you know, absolutely used to be people thought there weren't any innocent people being convicted in the courts. And then DNA testing came along and we suddenly realized that, yes, there were many people who had been convicted. And the DNA testing would not only prove conclusively that they were innocent, but also identify the person who actually committed the crime. And since then, we've seen this over and over, like with Glenn Ford, people who are convicted on very sketchy evidence because there really was no defense in the case. There was no investigation by the defense, all white jury. It was a prominent member of the local community. And so the outcome of the case was a foregone conclusion when the trial started.
And so I have a lot of quotes here because I got to tell you, many times when in the course of this book, I see a lot of great quotes for people to remember. And one of the things that you write is that such breakdowns caused by unchecked prosecutorial power, inadequate lawyers for the accused, biased or indifferent judges, and racial discrimination occur far more often than is generally acknowledged. With the creation of the 24-hour news cycle, of social media, and people being really involved in cases online, do you think that the practice of trying to do a better job in looking into cases has improved because so many people are focused on the mistakes that are made, or do you think it's about the same as it has been over the years?
I think that, you know, the rise of cell phone camera and social media has certainly had an impact on law enforcement and the criminal legal system. I think, you know, we've seen most visibly in the past 10 years, you know, we know about unjustified police killings of people, often young black men, because of cell phone cameras and social media. And that tragic problem has justly gotten a lot of attention. One thing that we talk about in the book is that these kinds of unfairnesses, including, you know, racial discrimination, persist past the time that people are arrested and brought to jail, right? So there's been a lot of attention to police violence. There's a lot of, you know, violence being done by the legal system that I think has gotten less attention because it's less dramatic. It's harder to put onto social media. So, I mean, to answer your question, I would say yes and no. I mean, there have certainly been high profile cases, such as the case of Curtis Flowers in Mississippi, where people have eventually been exonerated or had their death penalties overturned because of, you know, modern journalism and podcasts and people and the increased ability to dig into the facts. I mean, you know, it used to be much harder to reinvestigate cases than it is now. That said, I think that's really only the tip of the iceberg. You know, the vast majority of murder convictions that are obtained unfairly do not get the attention that they might warrant. You know, as Steve said, the DNA exonerations have really proven that there are fundamental problems in the legal system, even when it comes to determining who's guilty and who's innocent. But, you know, and we see in those cases, we see why these people were convicted. It's overzealous prosecutors, it's incompetent defense attorneys, it is jailhouse snitches, it's reliance on eyewitnesses, it's junk science. And we know that these same factors are at work in many other cases where there is no DNA evidence, either because it wasn't collected or because it was lost. So we know that these problems exist, but there are not enough spotlights to be brought on all of these cases. So I think that the particular injustice of wrongful convictions is a little bit less bad than it was 30 years ago, but it's still a serious problem.
And, you know, you both mentioned prosecutors. And one of the things that when I was reading your book that I would like our listeners to understand is something called the trial penalty. And you wrote about it, and it's kind of troubling, considering that it doesn't have to be based on any logic, but it's intimidation. In fact, this is what you said. You said the trial penalty can be the defendant's life. A prosecutor may seek the death penalty not because of a belief that justice requires it, but as a bargaining chip to obtain a guilty plea and a sentence of life imprisonment. Can you explain to our listeners how this practice came to be and why you feel it is important for them to know about it?
Sure. I mean, we talk about the fact that it's used as a bargaining chip, as you just said. But if the person doesn't agree to take the life sentence when the prosecutor is saying we're offering you a life sentence, but otherwise we're going to seek the death penalty, if the person doesn't take it, then the prosecutor has to follow through. We give the example of a woman named Kelly Gissendanner. She and her boyfriend were involved in what led to the murder of her husband. The prosecutor offered both of them. You can plead guilty. You get 25 years to life. You have to testify against the other. The boyfriend immediately took the deal, said, sure, count me in. I'll testify against her. Relationship has pretty much gone sour by now. She is not quite willing to do that. She really wants to be eligible for parole a little bit earlier, and they kind of quibble over that. And so she ends up going to trial and gets a death penalty. And then has an exemplary record in prison. She'd never been in trouble before. The children of the marriage are begging state not to kill her. And yet, when the time comes to put her down, to put her to death, she didn't take the deal. And so she's executed because of failure to take the deal. And as I said earlier, this plays out all the time in all kinds of cases. It plays out in cases where, a person's facing 2 or 3 years and is told if you go to trial, you're going to get 10 years. So that's the trial penalty, the amount of money the amount of time you end up getting because you exercised your right to a trial. And so a lot of people that are serving some of the longest sentences in prisons are not there because they committed the worst crimes, but because they didn't take the plea offer.
And so it's correct to say that there is no real judicial oversight of plea deals or anything that happens before, right? That's just between the defendant and the prosecutor's office. Is that correct?
That's correct. And so formally, the judge has to determine that the plea was voluntary, not coerced, that the defendant knows what he's getting into, that the defendant was advised by a lawyer. Generally speaking, the judge asks, these questions very perfunctorily. The defendant says yes, and everyone moves on. There's no actual there. And at that point, the higher courts have basically said this is essentially a contract between the prosecutor and the defense. We're going to uphold the contract. That's what happens.
So for situations like this, I mean, have there been appeals that there is like a constitutional violation and that I wanted to exercise my right to trial, but I was penalized for it? Has there been any hope of arguments like that? Or is it something that, hey, you entered a deal, it got stamped and approved, and we're moving on? Is that what you've seen?
Yes, that's pretty much the system. I mean, the system is people pleading guilty. 97% of the convictions in federal court are guilty pleas, and about 95, 94% in state court are guilty pleas. So the courts allow this. In fact, I would say they encourage it because they don't want the cases to go to trial. It would take a lot of time to have trials. And as a result, very many cases are resolved with pleas. We talk about how with really minor cases, with what are petty crimes and misdemeanors, that very often people come to court. They meet a lawyer for 5 or 10 minutes. They're told, if you plead guilty, you'll get put on probation, or if you're in jail, you might get out today. And so the judge takes the bench a short time later. Everybody pleads guilty. There's been no investigation. There's been no assessment of the prosecution case. There's been no looking at what legal issues are in the case. It's called meet 'em and plead 'em. People just meet a lawyer, plead guilty, get sentenced. And while the people may think that today they're going to get out, people in jail often, and this is why innocent people plead guilty, because you're told if you plead guilty today, you'll get out. If you don't plead guilty today, your trial may be in several months and you'll have to stay in jail during that time. But what people don't realize is when they're released, they're put on probation and they're given a lot of conditions that they have to satisfy. And often it's such an entanglement that people can't do everything they're required to do. And it's very burdensome. And so they end up being hauled back into court later and locked up because they violated some condition of their probation. The other thing that's very prevalent is fining people, giving them, say, $1,000 fine. They can't afford it. They can't afford to pay it. The judge says, no problem. We'll let you pay in installments. You can pay over the next 12 months. But what that means is a private probation company will collect the installments at a cost of $40 a month. So now the person owes not just $1,000, they owe $40 a month. And for a lot of people that don't have any income or have very limited income, they're going to get further and further behind. And then when they can't pay, they're going to get locked up and they're going to be in the modern equivalent of debtors' prisons. And that happens all over the country.
So for our listeners and readers, and they want to address this issue, right? They want to do something. So is this something that can best be addressed through the judicial system, through Congress, the state legislature, or maybe even through public policy? I mean, what are ways in which your everyday person reads your book, wants to do something to help? What would you recommend they do?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of ways that people can get involved. So one thing we talk about is how, you know, we focus a lot on the election of judges. One thing we talk about less, but is probably equally important is the election of prosecutors. So the United States, in many ways, if you look at the United States and compare it to the rest of the world, especially, democratic societies, we're an outlier in many ways. We elect judges, which in most places would just be considered absurd that you would elect judges. We elect prosecutors, which perhaps is a little less absurd, but again, as we've said in the book and in this conversation, the prosecutor is, you know, the most important person in the criminal legal system. Many people think it is the judge or should be the judge. They're basically wrong. And so these important actors are elected, and these are generally down ballot elections. So one thing we talk about in the book that's a problem is that in the United States, elections both for judges and for prosecutors are generally won on campaigns of who can do the best to lock up criminals and keep them locked up. So I think that, you know, people can, and when I say they're down ballot elections, these are elections. They're often, you know, district attorneys are elected on a county level or some small level like that. There are elections where a few hundred votes can make a difference. So people can find out who their judges are, find out who their prosecutors are, and determine what kinds of positions they have. One thing we've seen in recent years is the rise of the so-called progressive prosecutor, right? So it's now that, you know, many people realize the prosecutor is the most important person in the system. One response is, well, let's get somebody else in. And in places like Philadelphia, Los Angeles, a couple cities in Florida, we've seen people who run on platforms saying, yes, I'm going to uphold the law, but I'm not going to seek the death penalty. I'm not going to try to lock up people for minor drug violations for as long as I can. I'm going to shift the resources of my office to focus on violent criminals instead of maximizing convictions. And in more progressive jurisdictions, some have won. Some, like Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, have had a major impact. I do want to say that, you know, we don't want to rely on the idea of progressive prosecutors for two reasons. One is there are many jurisdictions where it would be difficult for them to win, and more fundamentally, you know, the type of justice you receive should not depend on whether you're lucky enough to have. Be charged with a crime in a very blue district as opposed to a red district. I've spent a lot of time talking about that. The next thing I'll say is that a lot of important issues in the criminal legal system are actually local issues. So for example, you know, for better or for worse, mainly for worse, funding of public defender systems is in many places is a city or county issue. One thing we talk about that's gotten some attention recently is cash bail, right? So the problem here is that in many places, when you are arrested and charged with a crime, the amount of bail you have to post is set according to a fixed schedule without consideration of whether or not you can actually pay that amount. The result is people, you know, about two-thirds of the people in jail today are legally innocent. They're awaiting trial, and many of them are there simply because they're poor. This is unconstitutional, but it's still a common practice. So movements to contest cash bail have been largely local in places like Atlanta and Houston, and some of them have had success. So, you know, I will say in passing, the Supreme Court looks pretty bleak for the foreseeable future, but a lot of these issues are state issues or local issues where, especially on the local level, where, you know, a modest number of people can make a difference.
And when you were talking about the some places do not have public defender's offices, and so they also have where they appoint lawyers who are admitted to the bar in that area. And so the ones that you wrote in the book that there are some defendants that are, quote, assigned inept lawyers who fail to challenge constitutional violations. And the system resembles a lottery in which the fate of a person accused of a crime depends upon whether he is lucky enough to be assigned a competent lawyer at each stage of the process. Does the court have a duty to make sure that defendant has a capable attorney, not just an attorney, but one that actually knows what they're doing? As we know that there are states in which the ethics rules require that attorney know they can come up to speed and they're able to, work the case. But what's your opinion on that?
Well, our opinion and what we say in the book is it's important that the system provide people with a structure that provides them with an independent lawyer who is competent and has the resources necessary to investigate the case and to present a defense. And unfortunately, that doesn't happen in many parts of the country. We do, and all the way through this book, we point out places where things are being done, where we are seeing justice achieved. And we look at somewhere like New Jersey or like Colorado, which have excellent statewide public defender programs that provide people accused of crimes with competent lawyers. But unfortunately, we look at many other places where there are no public defenders. You can look, and there's some places where there are public defenders. They may not cover but a few cases. They may be kind of small. Let's take Houston, for example. There's a very good public defender office, but many of the cases and the more serious cases are handled by lawyers appointed by the judges. And what happens, people run for judge, and lawyers make contributions to their campaigns, and then those people get elected and appoint those lawyers. It's a political patronage system, and people are being appointed to represent people, even in death penalty cases, not because they're capable of representing people in those kind of cases, but because they contributed to the judge's campaign. That's obviously an awful system, and it leads to some awful results. So one of the things that's needed all over the country are public defender programs. And we see, you know, very good public defender programs in some places. We see places don't have any at all. And then we see a number of places where, like Virginia, which is basically building out a public defender program, which still has a long way to go. But hopefully at some point in the future, we'll be able to provide people with competent representation in criminal cases.
I'd like to add, so to the question of whether the courts have an obligation to provide, to ensure that people accused of crimes have competent and effective attorneys, I mean, there are two answers. One is certainly under the Constitution they do, and under Gideon v. Wainwright they should. In practice, however, they've been failing at that obligation, and that's largely because of the courts themselves. So let's say you don't have a capable attorney. Let's say you have an attorney who sleeps during your trial. Pretty clear. Most people would say that's pretty clearly. You pretty clearly did not enjoy the right to counsel in that case. What happens? Well, you after your conviction is generally upheld on direct appeal, you can initiate another proceeding and argue that I did not have an effective attorney. And the problem is that the Supreme Court has said in these cases, the Supreme Court has made it very difficult to succeed on this kind of claim. So you have to You have to show that your attorney was extremely incompetent, because attorneys are presumed to be competent by the law. And then you have to prove that this made a difference. You have to prove that if you had had a competent attorney, the outcome of the trial would have been different. This is very hard. These are very difficult presumptions to overcome. So this is why judges are able to appoint incompetent attorneys and get away with it, essentially, because it's the current legal system makes it very difficult to succeed on this kind of claim.
And also, not to get too deep in the weeds here, but the stage where you would prove that, what James just described, that the lawyer at your trial was not competent and it made a difference, you don't have a right to a lawyer. So in death penalty cases, people probably will have a lawyer from somewhere that will represent them and will often show that the person did not have competent representation during their trial. But many other cases where people are sentenced to very, very long sentences, they have no and may have had a very incompetent lawyer, may have pled guilty after getting very bad advice from an incompetent lawyer. They may have a right to challenge that, but you've got to have a lawyer to do that, and they have no right to a lawyer. It's a real catch-22, and I think many people don't understand that.
So for people, for some critics who lack the empathy or lack the understanding of what the system is like, so I have to address the critics, right? So how do you respond to individuals who may say that there are people who use flaws in the system to their advantage, even when they may be guilty of a crime? They don't want them to have all of these advantages to try to be able to know the system in and out. But isn't that the point that you're making, that it's just a fear that it's a fear of too much justice, of course, but that fear is not really based in logic, because you want the system to work the way it's supposed to work? I mean, but how would you respond to people who would criticize having someone who knows what they're doing?
Well, I think that, you know, the idea that there are terrible people who are escaping punishment because of technicalities and very clever lawyers, I think is just overblown in American culture. I mean, it may happen. It happens. I think it happens very rarely. The second thing I would say is that, I mean, let's talk about an example of a technicality. Let's say somebody committed a crime, but the evidence against them is a confession that was illegally extracted by the police. I don't want to endorse illegal police interrogation tactics. And I personally think that's a conviction that should be overturned. But I think the best answer and the most important one is we want the legal system to be fair, and we want equal justice under law. So I don't mean just Steve and me. I mean, like, the vast majority of Americans. We want the outcome of your legal proceedings not to depend on your race, not to depend on how much money you have. And that means that everybody should have access to a capable attorney who has the time and resources to do a good job defending their interests. If occasionally somebody gets off on a technicality, and I mean, frankly, we're probably mainly talking about like white collar criminals, you know, people involved in securities fraud, and you know, those are the people who have the high powered attorneys who are getting off on so-called technicalities. We don't think this shouldn't be a society where rich people have one kind of justice and poor people have another. I think that's the most fundamental point.
Well, and theoretically, the system is one that says it's better for a guilty person to go free than for an innocent person to be convicted. And even if we have to have a system where some guilty people go free, that's what you have to have. I mean, James's example of that confession that's taken, the problem with coerced confessions is that very often the people confess who are not guilty. And so if you allow police practices which result in particularly vulnerable people, young, mentally limited, intellectually limited people are coerced into pleading guilty, often to things they didn't do, you got to remember, not only do you end up convicting somebody who didn't commit the crime, the actual perpetrator of the crime remains at large and commits other crimes. So everybody has an interest in the system being fair and the system being reliable. And our point is just it can't be fair and reliable when it's so out of balance between the prosecution and the defense, and when we're so reluctant to deal with issues like race discrimination. That's where we really see, that's where the title comes from, of the fear of too much justice, a case in which the Supreme Court said, if we deal with racial disparities in the infliction of the death penalty, we'd have to deal with race disparities in other areas as well. And Justice Brennan said, that's the fear of too much justice. I think that explains a lot of the deficiencies that we see in the system.
So when you were talking about the power of the prosecutor, you also wrote about the judges, which y'all mentioned before. So I want to focus on that. You wrote that impartiality requires that judges be insulated from political pressures. If either of you were advising a group of judges that handles these kinds of cases, how would you advise that they accomplish this task? Because they don't live in a vacuum. But they do have a duty under the law to be fair and impartial. So how would you advise that they address these issues in a fair way in the society that we live in?
Well, I think that would be a, I don't know if it would be an uncomfortable conversation, but I think that the challenge that we outline in the book is that, you know, judges have an obligation to the Constitution to uphold the constitutional rights of defendants. And to ensure that trials are as fair as they can be. And that means that, you know, if you're a state Supreme Court justice and there's a death penalty, a conviction and a death penalty that comes before you and it's being challenged by the defendant because the defendant had an incompetent lawyer and was subject to illegal police practices, I think that means that you have to do what the Constitution says. You have to overturn the conviction. You have to overturn the death sentence. And that obligation comes before your interest in winning the next election. I think that judges can certainly, in addition, I think that, you know, there are canons of behavior that apply to judges, developed by the American Bar Association, for example, which require them, not to take public positions on cases, that basically not to say how they would rule in an upcoming case. And I think that judges need to abide by these principles. And frankly, that's more important than whether they win the next election. I think judges could try to do a better job at educating the public in what their job actually is. And that could have an impact on changing the way that the public assesses candidates in these elections. But I mean, I acknowledge that, especially in some jurisdictions, the political pressures are clearly on one side of the scale. But we expect judges to be able to resist those pressures.
Steve, were you also going to add to that as well?
Well, I think there are two things we're concerned about. One, we want to try to have a system that selects the best judges we can select. I mean, there's a choice in selecting people. But secondly, once those people are selected, whatever system is used, we want to insulate those people from political pressures so that when they're deciding cases in the way that James just described, they decide them without worrying about the next election or worrying about political considerations. And one of the things that's happened an awful lot in judicial elections recently is that while the people who are interested in who the judges are very often the business community and the plaintiff's lawyers, but the issue that they use in the campaigns and the millions of dollars that are spent are crime. Justice Kilbride on the Illinois Supreme Court, one of the ads ran against him, had actors who were dressed up in jumpsuits like prisoners and were in a prison and talked about the terrible crimes they had committed and how Justice Kilbride voted for them when their case was before the court. Very emotional kind of ad. It really didn't deal with the issues that come before the court, but basically tried to scare people into saying that this justice was soft on crime. And so it's important that judges, one way that judges are insulated from that is a merit selection system, long terms for judges so that they're on the bench for some period of time and don't have to worry about looking over their shoulder all the time and thinking that if they rule in a particular way, they're signing their own political death warrant.
And so let's move to the other part of the courtroom, the jury. Okay, so you talk about the composition, the importance of the composition of the jury. And so a significant case in criminal law is Batson v. Kentucky, where a Black man was tried for burglary and the receipt of stolen goods. And during jury selection, the prosecutor used his peremptory strikes to remove all four Black people from the jury panel. The court decided that a defendant could raise a claim of discrimination based on that pattern. And if the defense lawyer objected to such a pattern, the prosecutor was required to give reasons for the strikes. And so this is often called a Batson challenge. Can you tell our listeners about the significance of this case? And from your research, is it helping keeping the process as fair as possible?
So I'll talk about the case itself and then turn it over to Steve. So the case was important in establishing a principle, because before this, the Supreme Court had essentially said it was okay to discriminate in jury selection on the basis of race. The standard before this was essentially that if you were a defendant and you wanted to win on this issue, you had to show that the prosecutor struck every Black person in every case that he had ever prosecuted. And in Batson, the Supreme Court took a step forward on principle, saying that you were not allowed to strike on the basis of race. And they established the test that you described. The problem is that, as Justice Thurgood Marshall said at the time, this test is not going to work. One way to look at it is the defense attorney says, "Your Honor, I think that the prosecutor struck this person from the jury pool because of their race." The prosecutor says, "No, I did it for these facially race neutral reasons. I did it because I don't like having steel workers on my jury panels." And then the judge decides if that was actually if that reason was correct. And as one observer said, for the defendant to win on this challenge, one elected official, the judge, has to say that another elected official, the district attorney or someone who works for the district attorney, is not only a racist, but is also a liar. And especially given that these people work together, they often know each other from years of experience, this is highly unlikely to happen. So I think I was going to turn it over to Steve to say kind of what's happened since then.
Yeah. Well, and that is what's happened, is that the courts have accepted, and starting with the Supreme Court, very trivial reasons. And so, for example, in one case decided by the United States Supreme Court, the prosecutor said the reason I struck the two Black men was they had facial hair. One had a goatee and one had longer hair. Well, that doesn't have anything to do with anything, but the Supreme Court said that's a race neutral reason. So what's happened now is prosecutors' offices have long lists of reasons, most of which have been upheld in one case or another. And so you just read a reason off the list. So anybody can do that. And so the result is that we have all white juries. You go places all around this country and even places that have a pretty substantial, let's say, African-American population, and you go in the courtroom and everybody there is white except the person on trial, the judge, the prosecutor, the defense lawyers, and you look in the jury box and all the jurors are white, and you say, wait a minute, this community is 20-25% African-American. That jury doesn't represent this community. But this practice continues of striking people on the basis of race, and it has perpetuated the all-white jury to this very day.
Well, there is a quote that you have in your book that I think for our listeners to understand, of course, the obvious reasons why you want to have a diverse jury, but I thought this quote was telling. I quote, "A diverse jury can reduce the influence of conscious and unconscious racism and increase the likelihood of a just outcome." And so it's so important, and as you mentioned, very common for not to have diversity in the courtroom. So how does a criminal defense attorney or even a prosecutor address this issue if they are in a city or a town where diversity is not as common? How do you find a jury of your peers?
Well, the thing a prosecutor can do is not strike all the people of color. You know, some prosecutors today don't exercise strikes at all because they, you know, they're happy to accept whatever jury represents to the community. But unfortunately, this practice of striking on the basis of race continues, as I said, all over the country. There are certainly places where it doesn't. And one state, we should mention, has actually done away with these strikes, peremptory strikes, Arizona. So we're going to see what happens in a state where neither prosecutors nor defense lawyers have the ability to strike people on the basis of any basis, but including race. Of course, what that means is it's totally up to the judges, the trial judges in those cases, who sits as jurors and who does not. And so we'll see how that plays out.
Moving up as far as how these challenges and things are going up through the ranks of the appeals courts, do you have any concerns with what this practice and what other things are happening before future cases before the court that we have? Are there any court cases that you're monitoring right now that you would like to share with our listeners?
Well, there's some cases in the lower courts. One that I would just say very quickly is a case in the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, where the question is, can you only reverse a case on habeas corpus review if the person is innocent? That's never been the standard, but it was the standard adopted by a panel of three judges on the Fifth Circuit. The case is being reconsidered by the entire court. So we'll see what happens with regard to that and then whether that gets before the Supreme Court of the United States. But I think the feeling based on the composition of the Supreme Court now with the Trump judges is that many things that have been decided by the court are up for grabs once again. And so we will see what the court does as those cases make their way there.
And so here is my last question for you. And I'm going to quote, I'm quoting your writing back to you because it's just good stuff here. You wrote, "The problems of the criminal legal system are rooted in the problems of our society, in racism and poverty, in the concentration of political power, in widespread indifference to our fellow human beings, and cannot be solved overnight. But we know how to start addressing them by taking seriously the ideals our legal system claims to uphold. There is, of course, no such thing as too much justice." What do you hope that readers will learn from reading your book? James, let's start with you.
Yeah, so I think two things. I mean, one is that there's a lot of unfairness. There are a lot of things wrong in the criminal legal system. Just about anywhere you look, big trial, big cases, small cases, power of prosecutors, lack of competent defense attorneys, and so on. As I mentioned earlier, there's been a lot of attention to police violence in the past decade. And I think that it's important for people to understand that the problems don't end once somebody's been arrested and booked and charged. And the other point, the other thing, major point, is related to the title of the book, The Fear of Too Much Justice, which Steve talked about a little bit earlier. The one thing that I think is striking, and I hope is striking to readers, is the extent to which the problems we talk about are in direct opposition to ideals that the vast majority of Americans hold. So I don't think we're talking about divisive, you know, so-called social issues where people actually hold very different beliefs about what is right. You know, abortion would be one example, right? We're talking about things like the fact that the outcome of your trial shouldn't depend on how much money you have. It shouldn't depend on what race you are, that you shouldn't be locked up in prison simply because you're poor. I think if you poll on these questions, you get pretty much at least 95% agreement. And the Supreme Court has even said these things. It said you have the right to a lawyer. It says you can't be incarcerated solely because of poverty, but it's failed to follow through. So I think, you know, we think of all political issues today as being highly polarized. We think, you know, we think particularly of views on criminal justice as being highly polarized. But I think we all share, virtually all of us share the same ideals. And, you know, the problems we point out, you know, we're not talking about whether, you know, prisoners should get, you know, gourmet meals in prison. We're talking about whether people should be in jail at all because they're poor. And that's the extent of the failings of the system right now. So I want people to understand that, the system is failing at, as Steve said, some of its most basic responsibilities, sorting out the guilty and the innocent, treating people equally. These should not be divisive issues.
And Steve, would you like to add to that?
Well, I would just add this. I mean, one of the things we do, as I mentioned a moment ago, is point out that if we can overcome our fear of too much justice and deliver a full measure of justice, it can be done. I think let's take the right to a lawyer, which is so fundamental, because if you don't have a lawyer, you've got no shot in the legal system, because you have to have a lawyer for all your other rights, because the lawyer has to know that and assert them. And the lawyer has to assess the prosecution's case, and the lawyer has to investigate to see if there's a defense, and the lawyer has to determine the legal issues in the case. And the fear there, I think, in most places is if we provided people with really zealous representation, like they're entitled to, we wouldn't convict as many people. It would take more time. We would have more trials. But the answer to that is that's what's supposed to happen. And if you look at a place like, again, New Jersey, or look at a place like Colorado, where people are provided with competent lawyers, and the legal system works much better because it's able to sort out issues of guilt or innocence, as well as all the other issues that courts are called upon to decide these days. In all these areas, race discrimination, we see some places like Washington, the state of Washington, that is really dealing with the problem of race discrimination in the criminal courts and is trying different ways to combat it. California adopted a different approach to peremptory strikes that we were talking about a moment ago. Doesn't require a finding of intentional race discrimination, just says objectively, would a person think race was a factor? And if so, then you don't allow that jury strike. So we see places that have overcome their fear of too much justice and are providing more justice. And that's just what we need to do in the rest of the country.
Stephen Bright and James Kwok are the authors of the book, The Fear of Too Much Justice, Race, Poverty, and the Persistence of Inequality in the Criminal Courts. You can read more about this book at their website, www.thefearoftoomuchjustice.com. Thank you both for speaking with us at Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you so much again.
Thanks, it's been a great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.